Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. By early May, more than 270,000 people have died around the world from the disease attributed to the new coronavirus. First identified in Wuhan, China, in November, maybe December, the virus has infected nearly 4 million worldwide, including well over a million in the U.S., which now lays claim to one in every four deaths. The first known coronavirus and its debilitating powers was identified early in the last century by German veterinarians. Since then, this family of virus has been blamed for everything from the common cold to the culprit behind the current pandemic. Frederick Bertley is a scientist and the president and CEO of COSI. He has a doctorate in immunology and has worked internationally in preventative medicine and basic vaccines in Haiti, Sudan, and the Canadian Arctic. He also researched immunopathogenesis with a group at Harvard Medical School developing DNA vaccines for HIV/AIDS. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Ann. It's a pleasure to be here.
And listeners, we're talking about viruses today. We're talking about immunology today. If you have a question or comment for Frederick Bertley, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Frederick Bertley, when did humans start to understand how viruses spread?
You know, it's funny. I mean, it really started way back, you can actually go back into antiquity from the Egyptians to a whole bunch of other early civilizations. There's evidence of Imhotep, who's considered to be the father of medicine. And then later, you have Hippocrates, who studied under Imhotep, the famous Greek physician who we practiced the Hippocratic Oath, etc. I mean, different cultures, the Asian culture. There's evidence historically of different people dabbling. But we really fast forward to about 1790s with Jenner, really came up with the first vaccine, and he was working with smallpox, and that's when scientists really decided, okay, maybe this is a field that can grow and we can exploit to help save lives around the globe.
How did they learn that by infecting somebody, you help protect them?
By today's standards, Anne, it's completely crazy. Jenner in 1796 actually took a boy, 8-year-old boy, not his son, and essentially affected him with the pus of smallpox. And then 2 months later, he didn't die. He had a mild kind of reaction, but he didn't get really sick. And 2 months later, Jenner again challenged the boy with a higher dose of smallpox, and the kid survived. Didn't get sick and survived. And so that's how we knew that, wait a minute, there is this system. At the time, it wasn't called an immune system. That term came much later. But that there's something in the body, some biological mechanism that allows you to, if you get exposed to a pathogen or a bug, that might tickle your immune system to create an army, if you will, or a stronger response. So if you see it later, you'll be okay. Now, that could never be done today. Imagine, you know, our laws trying to approve you working with a kid and infecting him on purpose. I mean, we can never do that today. But that was the birth of immunization.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about immunology today. Why? Well, we all know why. It's because of COVID-19. Frederick Bertley is a president and CEO of COSI. He holds a PhD in immunology, and he's worked internationally in preventative medicine and basic vaccines. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, I finally know that the coronavirus is so named because of what it looks like. What is it about the family of coronavirus that can be as benign as the common cold in one branch and so lethal in another?
Yeah, I mean, that's a terrific question. Slight mutations in viruses or bacteria can allow you to go from absolutely benign to lethal. I mean, look at E. coli, for example. Every year, every second or third year, we hear about these E. coli outbreaks. And E. coli, of course, is a bacteria, not a virus. But we hear about these E. coli outbreaks. You know, watch your lettuce, watch your vegetables, this and that. But our gut has millions, actually has billions of E. coli in our gut. And it's really just a small mutation can move you from absolutely crazily lethal to totally benign. And so that's what we're finding out. So there are a family of coronavirus-type structures out there that some of them, like you said, cause a common flu that we can get over with. Some of them don't even cause flus in humans, but cause flu-like symptoms in animals. Others can actually cross into humans and become lethal. And so it's really just that small genetic variation that's enough to take you from healthy to a really troubling pathogen.
Does what it looks like with all those spiky things coming out of it, is that significant as far as how it's shaped?
Absolutely. So it's really interesting. Evolution is king here, king and queen, and the virus has evolved these spikes, and many viruses have them. They don't have them just because they look cool graphically like a corona, but they have them because that's actually the mechanism by which they get inside a cell. Now, it's important for everyone to understand viruses are one of these things that are in that quasi-space that scientists have not labeled a life form. Bacteria and everything else are considered actually life forms, but viruses aren't. And the reason why is they cannot replicate on their own. Everything else, the number one tenet to being alive is you have the capacity to replicate on your own or with your species. A virus can't do that. So it's evolved these sticky things that you call these spikes that are actually glycoproteins. So they're part sugar and part protein. And those spikes allow them to bind to a host cell, a target cell, which it needs to do to be able to replicate. All the virus wants to do is to replicate. And so through the spike, if you think about getting into your house, right, you walk to your house, you have to take a key out of your hand, you stick your key in the lock, you turn the lock, then you can enter the house, right? Well, that's what these spikes do. The spike gets to the cell, and with its spike, which is a key, it pushes its key into the lock, which is a receptor. In this case, in the case of coronavirus, it's the ACE receptor. And once it binds that receptor, the cell, literally like your house, opens the door and allows the virus to come into the cell. So that's why those corona-like structures, those spikes, are on many viruses. It's a gateway, a mechanism for them to get into the cell, which they need to do, otherwise they wouldn't be able to replicate.
Okay. And when it replicates, does it stick with the same one cell, or does it need to get another cell inside the body to do that?
Great question. So again, a virus, talk about something having a one-track mind. Virus just has a one-track mind to make more copies of itself. So it gets inside your one cell, and in a very rude way, frankly, it hijacks your cell machinery. So it uses your nucleus, it uses your proteins, it uses your enzymes to replicate parts of itself, and then it assembles it partially inside the cell. And there's different viruses that do different things. In the case of coronaviruses, which are retroviruses, they assemble parts of the virus in the cell, and we're talking about millions of virions. So you get one virus gets into you, and it doesn't replicate like bacteria 1 to 2, 2 into 4, 4 to 8. It goes from one virus to can make hundreds of thousands to millions per cell. And then what it does is it actually migrates the structures to the inside of your cell membrane and does what's called budding off. So if you've ever seen a lava lamp, the way the lava lamp kind of bubbles up from underneath and then these bubbles float to the top, that's how coronavirus actually comes out of the cell. And so you go from one virus to many, many viruses or many virions, and then those go look right adjacent. Is there another cell with that right receptor? Boom, if there is, it'll bind. If there's not, it'll keep floating around until it finds the cell with the receptor to bind. So it does want to go from cell to cell to cell and just keep replicating.
What about it picks human cells over another living cell in another kind of species?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. So it all has to do with that lock and key mechanism. Right now, the COVID-19 glycoprotein is specific for what's called the ACE receptor that's in human cells. It's also on other cells, frankly, but it's in human cells. Anything from lung tissue, kidney tissue, different tissues throughout the body express this ACE 2 receptor, and that's why it's specific for humans.
And does it attack things like the lungs that we've found? It creates a respiratory disease because those are the cells that are easiest to attach to?
Yeah, and it's important for people to understand what happens, why people get sick, and unfortunately why the ones who can't ultimately survive and pass away. So to your point, it's a respiratory virus, so it's got an affection for the lung tissue. It gets inside your lungs, and then once it's inside your cells, right, our cells have an alarm system. So once the cell is infected, the cell itself, so our human lung cell, rings an alarm, if you will, that says, wait a minute, something's wrong, I'm infected. That alarm goes to our immune system. And so our immune system reacts vigorously. And so what you've been seeing are three types of populations. Those who are asymptomatic, but clearly were affected. Those who got infected, got sick for 2 or 3 weeks, you know, had some tough time breathing, whatever, but were able to survive. And then the third group got sick and ultimately, unfortunately, passed away. That sickness that you're feeling, so in that second group that goes through the flu, and the third group that gets really sick and starts to get pneumonia, fluid building up in the lungs, that's actually because of your immune response to your cells being infected.
Okay.
So unfortunately, the immune system, which keeps us alive for all our lives, prevents us from pathogens hurting us and whatnot, that's the same system that unfortunately causes ultimate death in us. Because what happens is once the virus has infected the cell, like I mentioned, rings the alarm. The immune system comes because it wants to prevent and clean up that infected tissue. But by doing that, it creates a process called apoptosis, which is programmed cell death, which is to trigger any infected cell, in this case, any infected lung cell, to die to prevent further spread of the virus. So the immune system's trying to do a good thing. It's trying to control and rid the virus from the body. But unfortunately, sometimes it can react really strong, and that's why you get what's called an inflammatory response. And it can be really strong, and it brings in all these proteins, all these chemicals, in an effort to squash the virus. But unfortunately, it can kill off a lot of our own cells. And if you're really sick, if you got pre-existing conditions, if you're weaker, it could ultimately lead to your death.
And the pre-existing condition things are the underlying conditions that we hear a lot about in regards to this. In those cases, someone's more vulnerable because their immune system's already working.
Absolutely. And the pre-existing conditions can be several. If you're immunocompromised, right, and you don't have a strong immune system, that's a bad thing because you don't have a strong immune system, you're not going to be able to fight it and the virus will wreak havoc on your body. If your immune system is okay, but you're suffering from diabetes or you have some other condition that just is taxing, if you will, on the body's energy and the body's capacity to deal with stuff, that might make you possibly further at risk of this virus. And so just think of it as, you know, my analogy that I like to share with people is if a 20-year-old falls from a one-story building, right, a 20 to 30-year-old or even a teenager falls from a one-story building, you know, they'll probably get hurt. They may even break a limb, but they'll probably get through it. If an elderly or a seriously ill, compromised person falls from a one-story building, there's a good chance they may not survive. So it's just the idea of if you're not as fit, quote unquote, or strong as you should be, whether that's a pre-existing condition or some type of ailment, that's always going to make you more susceptible to any infection, frankly.
You know, a lot of times when we hear about the flu, pardon me, we hear that it can be especially harmful to older people and very young people.
Yeah, I mean,
in this case.
Yeah, the older people issue with the flu is you know, if you think of your computer with your memory and the hard drive, you know, computers have a lifespan, whether your laptop is a 3-year or 4-year lifespan. Things just kind of happen with age, right? What happens with the immune system, as you get older, frankly, it just gets weaker. Right, and so you have a robust immune system as a teenager into adulthood, but as you get older, like many other things that happen with biology in aging, your immune system gets a little weaker, and therefore you're more at risk from something like influenza, the common flu, which most of us can deal with, but when you're older, it's harder to deal with, and you could lead to your passing. In terms of young kids, what's really interesting with young kids getting exposed to that is it's all about timing, right? When we're born, we have what are called maternal antibodies. That's antibodies that were passed on by the mother, usually through breastfeeding and through the placenta. And so you're armed coming out the womb with some level of immune protection. But it's not great because the second arm of the immune system is called your cell-mediated immune system, and that takes time to ramp up. And pretty much by the time you're a teenager, early teens, or by the time you're entering puberty, you're in good shape, and now you have two really strong arms. And so in that early period, you can be vulnerable as a youngster to some pathogens, and that's why you see that with influenza.
The last couple of times I got a virus, I don't know what it was because I never was tested for it, but it was definitely something where 1 minute I felt fine and then like a switch went off.
Yeah.
I felt it. What is that? Is that when it attacks the cell itself, or is that after it's multiplied and reproduced enough.
That's exactly right, Ann. So, you know, when you get infected with a virus or any pathogen, you know, it's in your body. And that ringing of the alarm that I said, that takes sometimes a little bit of time. You have to have a high enough level of kind of immune response to be able to or alarm bell ring to trigger that immune response. And what happens in the case of viruses, it's normally like a 7 to 10 incubation period where you get infected and the virus is ticking over. You're feeling fine. The virus is ticking over. Mm-hmm. Then day 7 or 10 or 12, you start feeling funky. And literally, to your point, the next day a switch goes off and you're flat out hurt. That's because the virus was replicating, and it's not a linear curve, but it's more exponential. And once you get to those very high levels, your immune system has been battling that virus from day one or day two, and so your immune system is also in hyperdrive, and it's the immune system that produces these things called cytokines, which make you feel pyrogenic or feverish. That's why you spike a fever. It also makes you feel weak in the joints. You also feel achy all over. Those are all evidence that, frankly, you do have an immune system that's working. So it's kind of a good thing, and most of the time, you defeat it, and then you feel better in 2 or 3 days after that, and then you go back to being healthy. So that switch that you're talking about, you've been infected for several days before you felt that switch, but that switch turning on is really, oh my gosh, my immune system is in hyperdrive right now doing its job, so thankfully it's doing its job, but it's making me feel crummy.
We are talking about immunology, viruses, bacterias with Frederick Bertley. He is president and CEO of COSI. We're going to talk about COSI later, of course. But he also holds a PhD in immunology and has worked internationally in preventative medicine and basic vaccines. If you have a question for Frederick Bertley, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're really looking for listener calls about questions about this field of science. I encourage it. 614-292-8513. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. First identified in Wuhan, China in November, maybe December, the coronavirus by May has infected nearly 4 million worldwide, including well over a million in the U.S., which now lays claim to one in every four deaths. We're taking your COVID-19 questions today, something we've been doing for the past several Fridays. Please give us a call, send an email. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll try to get to as many as we can because with us today is President and CEO of COSI, Frederick Bertley. He's a scientist with a PhD in immunology. He's worked internationally in preventative medicine and basic vaccines, including HIV/AIDS. Thanks again for joining us, Frederick. Really appreciate your time today.
Always happy to be here, Ann.
Why does it, if as long as, I'm just picking up right where we left off, as long as the virus has a body, why does it jump to another body?
That's a good question.
Is it? I don't know.
No, that's a great question. Again, it's a fascinating story because if there was only one body, right, on the planet, the virus would wreak havoc. And if that body had the power of having an immune system to shut it down, would shut it down, that virus would go away. If the virus kind of won the battle, it would kill that body. But guess what? In killing that one host, it would also die. It would have a normal life because there's no other people to infect. So the virus, again, its only goal is to replicate. And so it needs a myriad of hosts. And that's why this one is particularly insidious, because we've not seen it before. Therefore, we have no host, meaning no humans of the 7.7 billion have developed an immunity to it. And so what it does is it infects you, and its goal is to get to somebody else, and we unwittingly share it through coughing and sneezing and different ways of our fluids getting out there, and it just latches on to anything that's got a receptor that can allow it to replicate. So it's not trying to be mean. It's not trying to discriminate. It's not trying to necessarily pick this body versus that body, its sole goal in quote-unquote life, and again, it's not really life form, but its sole goal in its existence is to replicate, and it needs bodies to do that.
If somebody's asymptomatic, does that mean, what does that mean? Does it mean they're immune to it or no?
Yeah, I mean, and that's a great question. So right now, we just don't know. We're studying that, like our scientists are studying that like crazy to figure out what's going on in that subset of people that can actually be infected and not be symptomatic. We don't know. One guess is they probably have had luck that their immune system reacted quickly and was able to squash it and control it. Another possibility is they might not be expressing or having enough or a high enough concentration of the receptors. Back to the lock and key mechanism, they may not have enough locks on their cells that allow the key of the virus to actually penetrate. So we don't know yet. I know scientists are literally collecting both serum, blood and serum, as well as immune cell tissues to actually look under, to analyze to see what are the correlates to protection. Why are these people clearly infected but showing no signs of it?
So if you're asymptomatic, you know you had the virus, you've been tested for it, but you're asymptomatic, Are you going to get a call from somebody?
That's a good question. The way volunteers work in terms of medicine is there's a network of scientists who may be working on something, and they may have a relationship with hospitals and say, hey, if you came across somebody who, for whatever reason, you tested them, which is very unusual because, remember, if you're asymptomatic, why would you be getting tested in the first place, right? But let's say you get tested. There are some hospitals might have registries. They may trigger the scientists to say, hey, we got, Frederick Bertley, this guy who clearly he had to get tested because he was going somewhere, and so they needed to make sure he wasn't positive. Turns out he's positive. He clearly had the virus, but he's showing no symptoms. Call him up. Maybe he can help us figure out what's going on by volunteering a blood sample.
Yeah, I remember when I had a scratch test done for allergies, and they said, wow, you're really allergic to whatever.
Yeah.
And when you get a positive for something like the coronavirus, are there some stronger positives and weaker positives? Extra kind of a test or something that they further look at?
Yeah. So in the case of your allergy test, that's usually a skin test. Uh-huh. Where they prick to your skin with something, either a bunch of things or one thing at a time, and then they look at what's called an allergic response or an inflammatory response. How big is the redness, et cetera. When they're testing for your positivity or reactivity to coronavirus, they're actually getting a blood sample. Either a blood sample or your swab from your nose or your mouth, because it really, the virus likes to go through, it's called the mucosal tissues, so the mucus areas. Mm-hmm. And then they do a test and they look for two things. They either look for antibodies. Do you have any evidence of antibodies there? That's why you hear the antibody test. And again, that's a product of the antibodies are a product of your immune system reacting to this foreign agent. Mm-hmm. And there's what's called titers or concentrations or levels. So different people may have different levels of antibodies. And the rationale is those who are asymptomatic probably have higher. We're still waiting for the data, so we can't say that definitively. The second test they look for is using something called PCR, which doesn't analyze anything from the human. It actually analyzes, is there presence of viral RNA, meaning is there presence of the virus in your body? So not your antibodies to it, but is there evidence, like a forensic scientist looking for, where did the virus hide? Can we find parts of the virus? And that's done through something called PCR. And again, there's levels, right? So you can imagine if you detect a ton of genetic material, then you're probably infected at a very high level. If you detect a very little amount of genetic material, then maybe you're at the beginning of your infection. So there's always a range. Okay. But again, this is an ongoing experiment, and we are really looking at this stuff in real time.
Katie in Columbus, you're on the air with Frederick Bertley, CEO, president of COSI. Hi, Katie.
Hi. I wanted to ask, it's kind of a general question, what sources of credible information can the average person access and understand, especially in light of all of these conspiracy theories that we're seeing thrown out there? And I'm just kind of getting really annoyed that the average citizen thinks they're a doctor now.
I don't.
Right.
Yeah.
I'll take the answer.
All righty. Thanks, Katie.
Thank you.
Katie, thanks for that question. That's a great question. I get that often. First of all, the CDC, and we can forget about how fast or slow the government responded. That's neither here nor there. The CDC NIH.gov or NIH.gov are great resources of reliable information and information that's updated literally daily. And I say it's a great source because they don't just put up information. They put up information that's vetted by their scientists and their medical professionals. So anything that you're seeing updated on something like CDC.gov or NIH.gov, they literally vet that information thoroughly. So you can go there. And secondly, when you go to those websites, they have so many resources. And so just by going to those two websites, you scroll down, you navigate the website, there's all these additional links that also have been vetted with great information. So that would be my recommendation. You know, the internet's an amazing tool. Google's a fantastic resource. But to your point, it's just flooded with information. And because this is so serious, you know, I would really concentrate on those kinds of websites. Otherwise, if you want to read medical journals, those are also peer-reviewed. So if something is published in Science or in Nature or in the New England Journal of Medicine, that's a reliable thing because it's also been vetted as well.
Chris in Worthington, you're on the air. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I have a question. My daughter is considering taking a job as an in-home healthcare provider for two folks that are working in the medical field. Okay. And I didn't know if that like increases her risk of getting the virus, if that's a smart idea, not a smart idea.
Yeah, so quick question. The two people who work in the medical field, I guess they haven't been tested. Is that the issue?
I'm not sure. I think they both work at a hospital.
Yeah, so I mean, if the best case scenario is they were tested and your daughter knows, okay, they were tested and are negative, so that's a safe space. If they weren't tested, ideally there was a 14-day window where they've gone through this, what they call the quarantine time, where they've been kind of away for 14 days and haven't had any symptoms. So that means either they weren't infected or they were infected and they're asymptomatic. I'm not going to give you any medical advice on that because I'm not a clinician, but I would say if your daughter can find out as much information about what they were doing in their work and how exposed they were to possible infected people with coronavirus in their microenvironments, that would be useful. But, you know, it's one of these things that we're at the beginning of this, and we just don't know how much the virus has penetrated our community. So great question, and yeah, great for you and your daughter to be thinking about that.
Well, good luck, Chris, with that. I'm turning now to Diane in Westerville. Hi, Diane, you're on the air.
Hello, doctor. I have a question about, I'm worried about the meat in the stores and all these plants that closed down because a lot of workers tested positive. What are the chances that the infected people may have passed the virus onto that meat, and what's being done about that?
Well, that's an interesting question. Can we pass the virus on? Can it live on, say, refrigerated meat longer than it would on a tabletop?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So first of all, because the virus we believe came from bats, it definitely can be passed along from different biospecies. In terms of meat industry, you know, one of the issues is we now know that the virus, if it's in a chilled atmosphere like your refrigerator, it can actually live longer. And in fact, if you think about it, that makes sense. That's why we have a fridge for our own food, right? It helps provide our food a longer shelf life, if you will. And so in the same way that works for our food, it also works for bacteria, it also works for viruses, and it works for parasites. They actually can live longer or survive longer in those spaces. So certainly if meat is contaminated, the virus can sit on the meat or with the meat packaging in a refrigerated space for a longer time than if it was out in the open in the warm sun. But the question is how much or what rate of infectivity gets passed on from a human who is infected with COVID-19 to pass it on to the meat that they're packaging. You know, we don't have that data yet either. So we do know that people are working in the food industry that are positive. That's not a great thing. We definitely want to, you know, as best as possible, minimize that from happening. But we don't know how, you know, unless they're directly sneezing and coughing on the meat, we don't necessarily know how much they're likely to infect the package. packaging or the meat that they're working on. But it is, to be clear, it's a concern. You know, and again, the toughest thing through all of this is all these great questions. We'll know 100% the answers in 18 months from now, or mm-hmm. 2 years from now, and 3 years from now. But now is the time where we're getting the data to figure it out and learn about all these things. So it's not great that people are infected working with food, that's for sure. But, you know, how many people are going to get contaminated by or infected by eating meat, I can't tell you that right now.
Diane, thanks for that call. I'm going to turn to Cliff in Ostrander now. Hi, Cliff, you're on the air.
Yeah, if some individuals who are asymptomatic have a strong immune system and those who get sick or possibly die have a weak immune system, is there a way to test those individuals pre-infection to determine what their level of immunity is?
Yeah, so that's also ongoing. So they're doing something kind of related to that. People who've gotten sick and recovered and are 100% healthy again, they've had volunteers, they've asked for volunteers to donate their serum. So this is if you take your blood and you take it out, as you know, blood is red. If you centrifuge it, meaning you spin it really fast, it separates into two liquids, a red area, and which are your red blood cells, and a clear area, which is your serum or plasma. That's where the antibodies hang out. That's where the antibodies stay. And so if you recovered from it, that meant your immune system worked, did a great job, and you got back healthy. So they're asking for your serum, your antibodies, to possibly, as you recommended, transfusing them to older patients or elderly patients or patients who are really sick mm-hmm. to see if those antibodies can help diminish the infection. In terms of trying to do it before they're infected, it's kind of hard because you know, if someone's not infected, they're not infected. And what we're going to do is develop a vaccine in several months to a year that would allow everybody to be protected. But it's unclear how we would approach someone who's asymptomatic now and let them help someone who's infected or uninfected. It's unclear.
Thanks, Cliff, for that. And let's see. Lots of calls. Jackie in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Jackie.
Hi. I didn't really need to be on the air, but I just wanted to say that the COSI director has been the clearest person to explain how this coronavirus works, what it is, how it affects us, and how the investigation is going forward. And I totally commend him because he is using layperson's terms so that we can understand.
That's why we brought him on.
Yes, and I would say, yay, I love COSI, and now I love you. So.
Jackie, thanks so much for that call. To that point, though, that's why I enjoy being at COSI, and that's one thing, you know, we're really proud about at COSI is we're able to make science understandable and digestible for the layperson. You know, we have great research institutions here, like Battelle is the number one research, non-profit research institution in the world, and that's right in Columbus's front yard. We have OSU with phenomenal labs. You know, you got Chemical Abstracts, but you know, the layperson can't really go into those spaces and talk to those folks. First of all, you can't really get in. And second of all, you know, you can't really access the scientists. And so that's one thing we pride ourselves at COSI. So thank you very much for that. That is my job. We enjoy it here. And thank you for supporting COSI.
Thanks, Jackie, for that. We are going to take a quick break, then get back with it. My guest, Frederick Bertley, he's president and CEO of COSI. He holds a PhD in immunology and worked internationally in preventative medicine and basic vaccines. And that's what we're talking about today because of you know what. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We are talking about immunology today. Taking your COVID-19 questions with us is President and CEO of COSI, He's also an accomplished immunologist, Frederick Bertley, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I wanted to spend a few minutes. We do have callers, and I want to get to the callers, Frederick, but I wanted to talk a little bit about COSI and what your plans are for reopening. I mean, what sort of equation are you thinking about?
Yeah, so like many institutions, we're closed, but we immediately activated something called COSI Connects. So you go to our website, cosiconnects.org. I stress that only because COSI Connects is a gateway of free information for anybody. When the school's closed, we produce a lot of information for the K through 12 space, so kids to work with your parents, experiments, things you can do at home, some great videos, and you can even do a virtual tour, 3D tour of our dinosaur gallery. So we're closed and bummed, but we know people like COSI, so we wanted to make sure there's a presence out there. In terms of your question about reopening, that's a great question. Couple of things. One, as a science museum, science center, we are going to defer to science and medical research and perspective in terms of when we should open. In terms of a timeline, I don't have the answer. I want to open as soon as possible because, like everybody else, we're taking a hit by not being able to be open for business. But the date, you know, we just don't know. And the things we're going to consider are, you know, really when we have a full understanding of how much the virus has penetrated the community, or saying it differently, how many people actually are carrying this virus. We know you can be asymptomatic. We know you can get it and recover, or we know you can get really sick, but we still don't know how many people have it because we haven't been able to test enough people. We don't need to test everybody in Ohio, but we need to test a critical mass of people, especially in the denser areas, the city areas, to see, is it a 20% penetration rate, a 40% penetration rate, 100%? And the reason why this is so important is because we know factually, if you get exposed to it, you will get infected. There's a whole bunch of other things out there that we get exposed to all the time that we won't necessarily get infected because we have a great immune system and there's immunologic memory. But because this is a new bug, no one had any immunologic memory. So if you get exposed to it, you will be infected. And so that's why we need to test as many people as possible to get a sense. The good news is Ohio is ratcheting up slowly its capacity to be able to test, but that's going to govern when we can open, because our number one priority is the safety of the people who love COSI, who come to COSI, our guests, and, of course, the safety of our team.
Do you visualize a day when you'll have a piece of COSI will be devoted to the COVID-19.
It's funny you say that. When you say devoted, you mean from an educational standpoint?
Yes.
Absolutely. I mean, we have this great area called Labs in Life, which is really our life science area. And we were actually in the middle of reimagining that from an exhibition content standpoint. And so we are very excited about talking about immunology, because we realize a lot of people don't know enough about immunology. People are always asking questions, for example, about vaccines. Mm-hmm. Should they do this? Should they not? Et cetera. So we're on that track anyway, to actually have some immunology and have some health science related stuff to bacterial infections and viral infections. Now, because of this, we'll definitely have something related to this. In fact, right now we actually have a kind of 2D, two-dimensional, four poster series that was produced by New York Hall of Science that we actually have in our building that shows you what we know about coronavirus. So we have a tiny little one now, but we're definitely going to explore that moving forward.
Okay, now let's see. I'm trying to get everything queued up here again. So, Elaine in Columbus, you're on the air with Frederick Bertley of COSI. Hi, Elaine.
Hi. First of all, great program.
Thank you.
Dr. Bertley, where are we with a vaccine for the coronavirus, and why is herd immunity necessary, especially for those who are immunocompromised?
Wow, great question, Elaine. So, Tubit, where are we with vaccines? That's on everybody's mind. There are about 100 different groups or 100 different candidate vaccines that people are working on, of which we have about 7 or 8 that are getting along really, really far. In fact, just a week and a half ago, a group in the UK at Oxford University actually started the first clinical trial of a coronavirus vaccine. And I just want to explain to people what's involved in creating a vaccine, because it can take a really long time. The first thing, when you come up with something that you think is going to be a vaccine, you've done all these tests in the lab, the first place you have to test it is in animals. You're not allowed to just jump into human and give it a vaccine for all kinds of reasons. And so you normally test it in mice, and you look to see, hey, did it stimulate an immune response? You measured it in a mouse. Okay, it worked. The mice showed an immune response. Then you go the next step to what's called non-human primates. So think chimpanzees, gorillas, rhesus macaques, monkeys. Those are very close to us as humans. And so historically, if we can prove a vaccine works in that group of animals, non-human primates, there's a great chance it could work in humans. And so the group in the UK has actually done that. They've started their vaccine, they tested it in mice, then they tested it in monkeys and in chimpanzees, and actually worked really well. So they got the green light to now do what's called a clinical trial, right, to test it in humans. For vaccine development, there are three phases of clinical trials: clinical trial one, clinical trials two, and three. The first one is just to see, is the vaccine safe? We're not even testing to see if it's going to protect the corona or not. We want to know, if we inject this stuff in people, will people be safe? Will they not get sick? So that step has actually started,
get
I think, about a week
other
and a half
than
ago.
The disease. In other words, get sick from the vaccine.
Yes, yeah, gotcha. Thank you. Get what's called an adverse effect, yeah, or, you know, et cetera. So nothing to do with coronavirus specifically, just can they handle it, is it safe? And they've done that. They've tested about over 800 to 900 people. And the point is, you've got to wait a little bit. You can't just go from there and then go to phase two and phase three. So after you do that and you give enough time to look for adverse effects or people getting sick, and you get the approval to do phase two. The purpose of phase two is twofold. One, to increase the number of people. So if you've tested 800 to 1,000, you know, that might not have been a big enough denominator. So now you want to test, you know, 5,000 people or 10,000 people. So you expand the number of people you test. But the second thing is, now you're looking for an immune response. You're measuring in the person, hey, did they develop a coronavirus-specific immune response? Can you find antibodies, and can you find immune cells that are called T cells that can react to coronavirus? That's the clinical trial step two. The third step, if that works, is, okay, we want to see if this is actually going to control the spread of coronavirus. And this is where things are so difficult, and this is where it can take a long time. So again, you vaccinate a bigger pool of people, but you have to vaccinate people that are in an environment, a city, a town, where there is coronavirus spreading, because the only way you could know if the vaccine is working is if all of a sudden you vaccinated people and you're noticing the spread of coronavirus drops off. So you hear about flattening the curve. Mm-hmm. Forget about flattening the curve. This would be the curve would fall off a cliff, mm-hmm, right? If the curve fell off a cliff, you know that, wow, that vaccine must be working because people aren't getting sick at the same rates. The problem for that is you need to have enough people out there sick. So if our candidate vaccine comes out in November or December and coronavirus kind of has already passed, it's going to be a long time before you can figure out if the vaccine is working. Unfortunately, you'll have to wait for another outbreak or an epidemic, et cetera. So it's a tricky process. It's a long process. The good news for coronavirus is we weren't starting from scratch. So, for example, when you think of developing a vaccine for HIV, we had to start from scratch. We had no idea what to do, and we were starting from ground zero. In the case of coronavirus vaccine, the group that actually came up with this vaccine has actually built it off of a different vaccine that they created for MERS, which is another type of coronavirus. And so they didn't start it from ground zero. They had a good starting point, and they tweaked that a little bit. And Anne, back to your spikes on the virus,
yeah,
that's what they're making the vaccine for. They're making the vaccine against the spikes on the virus because they think if they can cover the spikes on the virus won't be able to bind the receptor, i.e. the virus won't be able to use the key to get into your cell.
Okay. Elaine, thanks for that question. Turning to Lana now in Columbus. You're on the air, Lana.
Yes, thank you so much for this show. Mm-hmm. My husband and I are in our late 70s, but we have no other pre-existing conditions. And our daughter is a health coach and has been suggesting and giving us immune-boosting supplements. And my question is, will these immune-boosting supplements just help us to prevent the coronavirus, or will it be harmful if we get the coronavirus and create that condition called the croptosis, I think? Or is it okay to keep taking these supplements?
Sure. So again, my precursor is I'm not acting as a clinician on this phone call, so I'm not giving you medical advice. But anything, I'll say it this way, anything you take that makes you healthy is a great thing for your body in general and a great thing for the immune system. And there, the, in terms of can it be a negative thing specifically and lead to what you said, I said the apoptosis thing, that's not at all. All if it is indeed an immune booster, for example, a lot of people are taking vitamin C, a lot of people are taking certain herbal supplements and whatnot. If it is an immune booster, it just means it's making your immune system a little stronger. And so what it means is the virus will still infect you because you have cells that express this ACE receptor, right? So you'll get infected, but you might be asymptomatic because your immune system might be stronger and controls it, or you might get sick and recover in 3 or 4 weeks, that like other people like has happened to other people. And so it's not going to cause this triggering and all of a sudden your immune system is going to be killing off your own cells. That's not going to happen because the apoptosis piece is specific, not just because you have a strong immune system, but it's specific to the immune system reacting to one thing, in this case, coronavirus. So that wouldn't be an issue.
Okay. Lana, thanks for that call. Mary in Grandview, you're on the air. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Listen, I basically have two questions. How concerned do we need to be of things coming from outside, like groceries or mail or the newspaper? And because there's all this business about people sanitizing their groceries. Mm-hmm. And then secondly, how concerned do we have to be about family and friends who are asymptomatic and, as far as we know, haven't been exposed?
Yeah, so the first question about groceries and your mail, you know, the guidelines are out there. I like to say take guidelines and then add a dose of common sense and act accordingly. The thing with the groceries that kind of buzzed in the media about a month ago or 3 weeks ago were because we realized that, oh my gosh, refrigeration of stuff can allow the virus to hang on longer. So if you were buying meats, if you're buying ice cream, if you're buying different things from the colder areas of the grocery store, hey, you might want to get home and wipe those off. Then it went from that to, okay, if you're buying cans or you're buying fruit or whatever, you might want to wipe that off. I mean, you know, I will definitely say err on the side of caution. If your grocery store is a hyper-busy grocery store and you got to squeeze by people in the aisle and people are touching everything, A, I would recommend not going to that grocery store. But B, if you are there, I would recommend, you know, being mindful and wiping down your stuff as you take them out the car before you introduce them into your house. If you go to a grocery store and you're the only person in there 17 rows, then I wouldn't be as paranoid. In terms of the second question, and I want to make sure I had it again. Repeat the second part of your second question. I want to make sure I answer it properly.
The second question was, like, for family and friends, like close family and friends, I haven't seen anybody really, except a couple people from a great distance, in weeks. So, like,
yeah,
close family and friends, how concerned, as far as we know, they haven't been exposed. So how concerned do I need to be, you know, with people like that?
Yeah, so this is to your point about the asymptomatic. That's where this gets really dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're asymptomatic, you don't know. And so you might think you weren't exposed to somebody, right? You might think, oh, I haven't done too much. I've been inside and I'm not feeling sick, you know, so I probably don't have it. Let me go visit my auntie. Well, if you're asymptomatic and you bumped into one person a week and a half ago, or a week ago, or a few days ago, you know, it's only one person in the last 4 weeks, but it was that one person who was infected, they may have infected you, and you just don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes it so tough. If we knew that, oh, there's nobody who could be asymptomatic, then we would know you wouldn't have it because you quarantined yourself for 15, 16 days, you didn't get sick, you know you don't have it. But we now know that there are people who are carrying it who don't know they're carrying it, and there's no way you can, you know, there's no way you can say with 100% safety and assurity that that person's not infected unless they were in a box for, you know, 15, 21 days, and you knew literally they saw nobody. So that's the unfortunate piece about that. And so, you know, we're all hurting. We want to see our grandmas. We want to see our friends and family. But it's you know, and this is where testing is perfect. I mean, ideally, if you had a test, you would just go and test yourself right now in your house or test your health, go walk to a clinic, do the test. And if you knew you were negative, then you can stay, you know, you can exercise that behavior and go straight to your aunt's house, for example. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. Go straight to your aunt's house. And you know that, you know, you're not going to infect your aunt.
Frederick Bertley, thank you so much for your time today. It's really been great. I appreciate your time.
And thanks so much for having me on. I'm a huge fan of your show, and Ohio will get through this. So thanks for your work on this.
Frederick Bertley is president and CEO of COSI. He has a PhD in immunology. He's worked internationally in preventative medicine and basic vaccines. Thanks to everybody for your great questions today. Thanks to the All Sides staff, our producers, Aaron Esmont, Matthew Rand, our interns, Atiyah Ture, Bobby Gerberic, and Max Garrison, and with video production by Nick Payne. Thanks again. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.